The following is presented by Le Sommet Coors Light, celebrity guests, entertainment, and oh, a bit of sports. Every Wednesday night on RDS.
What a night of hockey. Good luck following all of that tonight. Pierre, how are you?
I'm excellent, Mitch, and that Doc Emmerich's pretty good at what he does, isn't he?
Yeah,
wow, that guy's outstanding.
Yeah, the color guy's pretty good, too. We're going to get...
He's been my partner for 13 years, and I got to tell you, it never gets old. We've had so much fun together over 13 years.
We're going to get to the Tom Wilson hit in a couple of minutes, but I just wanted to ask you, first of all, the winning goal we have seen. I asked Rod because he tracks these things, but I think Rod has also lost count. The number of odd man rushes the Capitals have had in this series through just three games. What's going on?
Well, the initial part of the series, the odd man rushes were off of their stretch pass. They are left wing dominated on the stretch. So that means they usually move the puck from their left defense to their right defense, and they stretch the left winger out. So your right defenseman's got to pay attention. If he doesn't, you're going to be exposed. And usually you need inside insulation, so you have to have a back-checking forward to seal down the center lane on them. But they're a left wing dominated stretch team. And that's confused the Penguins, which is kind of weird because they play so much. But for whatever reason, it's caused some problems for them. Last night, though, the two-on-ones were because of bad pinches. Christopher Letang had a bad pinch in the third period. And Olli Maatta tried to make a responsible play. He got tripped down by Tommy Wilson. You can debate whether it should have been a penalty or not. But then, nonetheless, it was a great play by Backstrom on the two-on-one that lead to the Ovechkin goal.
That I don't know, you know, Joe Thornton, Adam Oates back in the day. I'm probably leaving somebody obvious out. But in terms of pure passing and setup guys, like part of me watching that play is going, geez, maybe he's holding on to the puck just a little too long, when in fact it was just perfect. Absolutely perfect. I don't know how many other players could make that pass outside of Nick Backstrom.
The person that reminded me of, and I thought the same thing as you, was Peter Forsberg. Peter Forsberg had that ability to hold the puck just a second longer and still make it a worthwhile scoring attempt. There are not a lot of guys that can do it, so you're right on the mark. I had the privilege of working with a guy that was pretty good at it too, Mario Lemieux. Gretzky was very good at it as well. There are not a lot of guys that could do it. Peter Mihalovic was very good at that, Mitch, if you remember back to our time. At holding it just a little longer and being able to make plays. Jean Beliveau, I remember when I was a kid, could do that really well. But, I mean, again, you're talking about rarefied air. There are not a lot of people that can make that play. You're 100% right.
Timo Hoblich still has the Canadiens record for most assists in a season with, I think it's 83.
That line wasn't bad with Lafleur and Schutt. That was okay.
Yeah, even though Schutt said it was the donut line.
Yeah.
Until Lemaire showed up. Okay, let's get to this.
Aston Reese was run hard, and he is shaken up. And it was Wilson. Meanwhile, this is thrown out in front, and a backhander is stopped by Murray, and play is halted.
There's blood by the gloves. Zach Aston Reese was over stick handling. Wilson came in at a high rate of speed, and he lets Zach Aston Reese have it.
Now, if we let that go further, when you got a chance to see a replay, you did mention, I should like to point out for those who weren't watching, Pierre did mention it appeared to be the principal point of contact was the head. He has spoken with the NHL Player Safety Department. What do you expect? I know you don't like to speculate at this point, but everybody they've spoken to has been suspended in the postseason.
Yeah, you'd have to think something's coming down, especially after their decision on Sunday not to penalize him for the hit on Dumoulin, and then obviously not to even have a hearing. So I would expect it. I don't know that, though, and that's why I'm really remiss in terms of telling you. Now, I want to be fair on this whole thing. I tried to do that last night. I hope I was fair. There's one angle that shows that it looks like it's shoulder to shoulder to jaw. That's the one angle. That's the angle that you would see from the penalty box side or from the play-by-play side that Doc Emmerich was working in. There's another angle, and it's taken from the box where I'm working. Our cameraman, Jack, has that angle. And if you see it, and you do eventually see it on our show, you see Zach Aston Reese's jaw basically bend. If a man's got a broken jaw and you see that picture of the jaw moving. It's like when you watch those boxing videos, Mitch,
yeah.
and you see the guy connect with a heavy right, and you see the man's face basically move.
Yeah.
That's what it looks like. And that would tell me the principal point of contact was the head because of the violent motion of the face after he gets hit.
Pierre, help me out here in terms of, because, you know, I've pointed out repeatedly, and you've been on this for at least a decade and probably a little longer than that, that any hit to the head should be penalized, intentional or not. You've been on this for a decade plus.
Because I saw it changing. I saw it changing, and I saw it changing because of the speed of the game. And because the league grew so much, a lot of players didn't have the same respect. You know, when I first started coaching the league, it was a 21-league team. Or a 21-team league, excuse me, I misspoke there. So there were 21 teams in the league. So you kind of knew the players a little bit more. It wasn't as great as knowing them in the 6-team league or the 12-team league or the 16-team league. But in 21 teams, you could still kind of figure it out. Now we're at 31. So you've added a lot of extra players. And another thing is the Iron Curtain came down, so you added more guys that nobody really knew growing up playing junior against them or growing up playing college against them. So you had all these different things. And I think that's when I really saw it start to change when the players, you know how they used to say there's no respect for one another? That's when I really started to see a change when we had expansion and we had the Iron Curtain come down. And that's when I started telling you this stuff. And I've been worried about it for a long time.
But there is actually something in the book, right? You can get penalized for a hit to the head. Can't you?
There's a lot of different ways it could have gone with that last night. That could have been called a charge. That could have been called roughing. That could have been called a lot of different things. That happened really. You heard the first thing I said is he came in at a high rate of speed. That happened so fast for the official. You can't even begin. Super slow motion does these guys major injustice talking about the officials. But, again, we'll see. The fact that there's a hearing tells me that, you know, they realize that that was a dangerous play. Pittsburgh's not making this up. Zach Aston-Reese has a broken jaw, and he has a concussion. He has to have surgery. He probably had it today. And he's done for the year. I mean, it's that simple.
Yeah, and it screams out after the fact. The rule Mitch is talking about is Rule 48, which is specifically about illegal checks to the head. When the head is specifically targeted from the lateral or from the blind side, that's it. 48.
Is that a 2-minute penalty?
I didn't think that was a 48, though. Personally, I didn't think that was a Rule 48 because Zach Aston-Reese knew it was coming. You heard what I said. He overstick handled. He's a young kid that really doesn't know the league yet. He knows a lot of the league, but he doesn't know the league yet. And you got to know who you're on the ice against and what he should have done there. And he was trying to make a responsible play. Is chip the puck and get himself prepared to protect himself, but he tried to make a puck possession play and he got himself into trouble because of it.
But everything's five. There's no such, there's no 2-minute penalty for a hit to the head.
No, unless you go with what Pierre suggested, call it something else, unsportsmanlike or charging or whatever.
Well, you could have called roughing there. Mm-hmm. You could have called charging there. You couldn't call elbowing because the elbow stayed in. But there were other calls you could have called. Listen, I not to be morbid, we showed the blood on the ice, and you can't make that up. It's not like they brought food coloring on the ice. The guy was hurt. He was hurt badly.
It's just some of the arguments you hear. I know where, and Sean is one of those people who believes it was a good hockey play here. I think what we have to take a step back here and realize where we are. You know, does anybody really want to go where Scott Stevens went with Eric Lindros and Paul Kariya? Like, don't we want to move past that? Larry Robinson was the hardest hitter of his generation. He didn't target the head ever. There is the capability of having clean, hard, bone-jarring, legal, open-ice hits without targeting the head.
We had one in the Tampa-Boston game in Game 2. Brian Callahan on Adam McQuaid. You can go Google it. Clean, hard, open-ice hit because McQuaid hung himself out to dry. He tried to make a puck possession play. Look at Game number 6, Philadelphia-Pittsburgh. Carl Hagelin gets lit up by Claude Giroux. Not a dirty play, not a dirty hit, clean, open ice, hard hit. Principal point of contact was a chest. in the shoulder in both those plays. That's why there was no penalty. Hagelin still hasn't returned to play because of the devastation of that hit. McQuaid didn't miss a shift. So you can still have that stuff. What I would say about that hit more than anything else, it was a hockey play, so I'm agreeing with Sean on that. It was a hockey play that went wrong. And it went wrong because Tommy is so big. Tommy Wilson's a big man, and he was moving at such a high rate of speed. And the player that eventually got hit was vulnerable because he was trying to make a hockey play with the puck. And rather than protect himself, he exposed himself, and that's why he got lit up like he did.
And there's a postscript to it. Chris Letang after the game said, look, I have respect for the way he normally plays, Tom Wilson. But to be laughing on the bench when a guy has to leave the game and is done for the year, that's just not acceptable.
Well, that was one of the things that really bothered the Penguins. And I can tell you again, Zach Aston-Reese is a really great story. A young man out of Staten Island, played in the USHL, went to Northeastern University, played for a Montrealer, Jimmy Madigan, who's done a great job with that program there. All 4 years, if you look at his progression as a player from his freshman year to his senior year, it's unbelievable. You know, he ended up being a Hobey Baker nominee his senior year a season ago before Pittsburgh signed him as a free agent. He's a tremendous story and a great person. But, you know, again, you look at the whole situation. There's no need to laugh. And when he gets up, and we showed this, I don't know if you had a chance to see it.
Yeah.
He takes his own glove and throws it at the bench.
That's why he did that.
That's how upset he is.
Yeah. Yeah. Thankfully, we got your feed last night, so that was a treat. All right, before we get to Boston-Tampa.
Ellis got tied up. Laine right on. Another chance. Laine across. Scores. Buffon.
When a guy who shoots it the way Patrick Laine shoots it as a goaltender, you are sold on shot. And what a pass he made over to Buffon.
Another pretty good team right there. Chris Cuthbert, Brian Boucher. Pierre, Dustin Byfuglien appears to be taking over this series. They came back, they tied it, and as you know, the Jets won the game. They were down by three. Two things. Dustin Byfuglien is the best defenseman in this series so far, and PK Subban, for those who would like to say that he's not even the best defenseman on his team, I hope you've been watching through three games.
Well, we agree on both those counts. The other thing is, I'm a big Pekka-Rinne fan. I've known him a long time. He's got to get in the series.
Yep.
You're three games in, and he's not in the series yet.
Pierre, we spoke about that early in the show. We know that Peter Laviolette likes the other guy. Is there any way that he goes to Saros here? Or
I can't see that. I could see it. I could see it potentially for Game 5 if Pekka doesn't deliver in Game 4. I'd be shocked, Mitch. I don't know if that's the message you want to send your guys, but Pekka's got to show up for the series now. I know he won Game 2, but his team really won Game 2. But I would say this, in his defense about last night, again, I had a chance to watch good portions of that, even though we were up against it with them. They stopped playing at 3-0, that was really apparent. And you can't do that. You cannot do that in a playoff game. You got to play as close to 60 as you can. This is one thing that I talked about today with a lot of my producers in particular. After the 2005 rule changes, with the red line out, zero tolerance on obstruction, you can't hold up for your defense partner, and now with the goalie rules and the coaches challenge, teams can come from behind now. I would tell you before 2005, if you were down 2-0 in a game, and I coached in the league then, you weren't coming back. You weren't. And if it was 3-0, forget it. Just load up in the fighting and get ready for game number, you know, 3 or 4, or whatever the game number is you're playing in. So that's an issue now in the league. If you stop playing because of the red line being out and because of the way they call the game, you're going to be in trouble. You're going to be in big trouble.
100%. I mean, we are seeing approximately 6 goals a game in the playoffs. That's unprecedented since the lockout era. We've actually seen goal scoring increase since the regular season. I mean, if you ever think that the opponent is down and out, you've got to be cognizant of this because everyone is talented. There's no gap in when it comes to skill set anymore.
No question. I mean, I can show you game number 1 of Washington-Pittsburgh. Washington's crushing Pittsburgh. They're up 2-0, and they're crushing them. And then Hornquist gets a goal off of Justin Schultz's shot to make it 2-1. And then all of a sudden, Crosby gets a goal, and makes it 2-2. And then the next sequence out, Crosby gets another, Gensel gets a goal off a Crosby shot to make it 3-2, game over. It happened in four and a half minutes. So, yeah, you can change the dynamic of a game pretty quick in this NHL, for sure.
We just came in here and, you know, talked with, you know, each other and, you know, just said, let's just keep it simple and do what we've been good at all year, and that was about it.
There's Dustin Byfuglien on what was said after they fell behind 3-0, just ahead of Boston and Tampa tonight in a little more than 90 minutes. Sean?
Pierre, just the stunning stat that the Jets have not lost at home since February. And last night, Peter Laviolette said, you know, after they gave up those quick two goals, I think it was midway through the second period, there was no point in calling a timeout because, quote, the barn was too loud. I mean, can you recall a team ever having a greater home ice advantage than the Jets in this postseason?
Chicago in the old stadium, they were amazingly difficult to play against. Most people don't remember that. Mitch Melnick and I do. It was so loud. It was overwhelmingly loud in that building. It was probably louder than any building that exists in the NHL today, the old Chicago Stadium. So that would be the only one that I could think of, Sean. But, yeah, no, you're right. There's only, by the way, everybody thinks that's a massive building. I've done World Junior games there. I've done NHL games there. There's only 16,000 seats in that building.
Yeah,
it's 5,000 seats smaller than Montreal.
Yeah, there appears to be twice as many people outside the building than inside. All right, just ahead of Tampa Bay and Boston, 7 o'clock start. Looks like Jimmy Montgomery has got his head coaching position with the Dallas Stars. It's not quite official, but it certainly looks that way.
Oh, it's about as official as they can get. I was made aware of this two nights ago when I was down in Tampa. I'm so happy for Jimmy. Hopefully this will hold up. I've spoken with Jimmy Nill about a bunch of different things, but we didn't talk about Jimmy Montgomery, but I'm thrilled to death. This is really a very good reward for a tremendous hockey person. I go a long way back with him. When he was playing for the Pembroke Lumber Kings in the Central Ontario Hockey League, I tried to recruit him to St. Lawrence University. So I've known Jimmy a long time, since the late 1980s. I'm a big fan. And he's worked his tail off to get this opportunity. So he'll do very well there. I know one of the things I'm really excited about in Dallas is to get into the new era of hockey, to utilize a stretch pass, to attack off the rush, to play more of a skill puck possession kind of a game. And Jimmy teaches those things. That's why Denver's been so good for so long and why they've developed so many good players at the University of Denver.
Anybody else come to mind while there seems to be a run on U.S. college coaches coming into the NHL?
Oh, I'll name you a bunch because I watched so many of them practice. I would say at UMass Amherst, Greg Carville, who's a tremendous coach, worked for Mike Babcock in Anaheim, worked as an assistant with the Ottawa Senators, was a head coach at St. Lawrence. He'd be one. Norm Bazin at UMass Lowell. He's as prepared as any coach in the country. I would see him being an NHL head coach if somebody wants to go the college route. David Quinn at Boston University, I think, is tremendously capable of being an NHL head coach. And you look at the players he's scouted and developed and have had turn pro, just phenomenal. Scott Sandlin at Minnesota Duluth, a former Montreal Canadiens draft pick, a defenseman. He's another one that I'm a big fan of. I watch his teams a lot, and I think he's tremendously good. So there's more than you think that are capable of doing it. Guy Gadowski at Penn State's another one. I had the privilege of coaching Guy when he was part of the Senators organization. So I got a laundry list of guys, Mitch. That's why I tell you all the time, you got to have lists on everybody. I think I know who the best trainers in the league are. I think I know who the best scouts in the league are. I know who the best coaches outside the league are. You got to have lists like that all the time. They have to be changing all the time. And if you don't, then you're not doing your job.
Again, congratulations to Jim Montgomery. Strong ties, of course, obviously born right here. And his dad, his late dad, Jimmy Sr., was a special guy as well. Finishing up with Pierre McGuire in Boston ahead of the Game 3 tonight. If I'm a Bruins fan, I'm a little leery of the number one line of Tampa. They're due to wake up.
They are. The big challenge they have, and if you won't be able to see our show tonight, but I've got tape prepared on what McAvoy and Chara have done to JT Miller, Nikita Kucherov, and Steven Stamkos. They're getting the Willie Nylander, Austin Matthews treatment from round one, and it's not easy to overcome that kind of treatment. So that's something to pay attention to tonight. But if you get a chance to watch a tape of it, you'll see what I'm talking about. And then the other thing, too, is I wonder, I don't know this, and I haven't spoken with Steven about this. This is where he fractured his leg, if you remember, the Olympic year going into Sochi, so 2014. And I always wonder about how comfortable he is coming here because of that. I had not spoken to him about it, but I know that was one of those moments in his career that he never forgot. And I'm wondering how much it affects him when he comes back to play here.
Pierre McGuire on site in Boston. Again, early face-off time, a little after 7 o'clock, 90 minutes from now or so. Thanks as always, Pierre. We'll do it again tomorrow.
Thanks a lot, my friend. I'll be in Pittsburgh. Take care.
Late game tonight, 10 o'clock, Sharks hosting Vegas. And a reminder again.
We talked. Mark and I talked several times about it. I just wanted to go to a different challenge, a new challenge. And for me, the other luxury is I've lived in North Carolina, and I actually owned a team in North Carolina, and it was a ball. I loved the state. I loved everything about it. So it's kind of, in one way, it's kind of going home for me.
Once again, the hockey gypsy, Rick Dudley, yesterday, the part of the conference call. Tomorrow afternoon at 1:30, Rick Dudley, the senior vice president of hockey ops now with the Carolina Hurricanes, will join Chris Nyland and Sean Campbell on Off the Cuff tomorrow afternoon, 1:30 on TSN 690.
Pierre McGuire, brought to you by Energy Transportation Group.